Hey guys, thanks so much for joining me for another podcast. I'm excited today to have Professor Shad Maruna from Queen's University Belfast with me. He's going to be talking about his research on desistance from crime, specifically how desistance is becoming a social movement. We're going to explore social movements, what that means. We're also going to talk about centering the lived experiences of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people as a way to push the desistance movement forward and create a more just society. We're also going to talk about the George Floyd murder and the uprisings that have been taking place since then, and how we can learn from the desistance movement and learn from other social movements, and how those techniques may be adopted to creating change in policing and to moving forward as a country and addressing the problems that we're all facing. So I'm really excited. If you want to support the show, hit subscribe. It helps to ensure that more people are able to access this material. Thank you again. Sit back and enjoy. Hey, thanks so much for joining me. I know it's busy for everyone and crazy right now, so I really appreciate you taking the time to spend it with us. And I just sort of gave everyone a brief intro of who you are and the sort of work you do. But before we start the discussion, I thought it's just to know a little bit more about who you are as a person. Maybe you could tell us like where you grew up a little bit. Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I'm nearby. I'm from downstate Illinois. You wouldn't have heard of it, in the cornfields, about an hour south of Champaign-Urbana. So an hour south of the southest part that anybody has ever gone in downstate Illinois. I'd lived for a little while outside of St. Louis on the Illinois side, the East St. Louis side, and fell in love with St. Louis. Certainly have strong connections to UMSL and hope someday to get back to UMSL. I've had a lot of good colleagues there and a lot of associations there over the years. But living now a long ways away in Northern Ireland, Belfast, and have been here for about 15 years or so.
About 15 years. And what you study, we're going to talk about today. Was there any sort of like a set of experiences that you had, or someone that you met, or some event, or was it an intellectual pursuit that sort of led you on the path that you ended up on and brought you to where you are today and studying what you study?
Yeah. It's a real good question, especially since, as we're going to talk about, I'm very interested in lived experience and biography and people's own narratives and so forth. So it's a very fair question. As you might have guessed, me growing up in the cornfields, I don't have a terribly interesting life story myself. That said, a very good friend of mine went to prison when we were both young. Others have along the way. And the idea of lived experience is you know, a part of my work, I think, in important ways. The book that most people know me for is a thing called Making Good, and it came out 20 years ago now. A lot of people will say it's the best thing I've ever done, which can be a little bit depressing considering I wrote it when I was in my late 20s. It came out when I was 30. I'm older than that now, but I think it's no coincidence that, you know, I wrote that book when I was the same age as the people that I was interviewing. It was a book about turning 30. I wrote it while I was turning 30. I was going through a lot of things. I had just had a daughter. I had just gotten my first real job after a long history of crap jobs, and I was going through the cliche of settling down and trying to become a grown-up. And the book is in some ways about that exact process of settling down and trying to become a grown-up. So I know there's a good bit of me, a good bit of the autobiographical in that book, although it's about other people's stories, not mine. My own story has influenced the way I interpreted and understood the stories of the folks in that book, for sure.
So it started off with sort of seeing these other people who you cared about go through this process of being incarcerated, and then you yourself experienced in the process of coming of age and moving through the life course, and then like sort of compare like thinking, were you thinking, well, if I'm going through these challenges, what would it be like to go through these challenges facing, was that what's sort of?
Yeah, 100%. You know, there's a lot of the work that I do that is universal. You know, people will read the book and say, you know, I've never been to prison, but this book spoke to me. I went through changes just like this. And that's because the people who go to prison are just like you and me. And so I've tried to write it from that perspective. It's not to say that you don't, that it's not a unique experience going to prison and getting involved in the criminal justice system in general, criminalization process. But there's a lot of that experience that is universal and it can be compared to and understood by those who haven't gone through the perspective. I mean, that's the whole nature of social sciences and the work that we do. But yeah, you know, I worked in a halfway house for a little while up in Alaska when I was in that string of low-paying jobs, as I mentioned before, becoming an academic, and that was important for me. There was certainly other formative events, but ultimately, yeah, I think I got interested in the work. Got interested in redemption as a notion, based on personal experiences, less than watching others, but more, you know, we've all had to overcome the worst things that we've ever done. We've all had to manage our shame. We've all had to deal with issues of moving on from different aspects of our life, and I think that's really what I was able to draw on in doing this work. Yeah.
And I identify with what you just said, because when I read the book, and then I could also identify with this. And I think that's one of the important things that this type of work can do, is make people realize that we're all human beings and we all experience the same sort of root things, but just in different contexts. It may play out differently, but we can identify with what that must feel like. So today we're going to talk about desistance, and some people may not even like really know what that means. Can you talk about like what is desistance, and people may be more familiar with the word rehabilitation. Can you talk about what's the difference between those two things?
Yeah. Great question. So yeah, desistance is a terrible academic word. It's hard to say, you know, for a long time people thought I was saying resistance, but people will know the phrase, cease and desist. So I usually bring them back to that. Since we hear that phrase, there's a reason we have the two words as different words. Cease and desist mainly means stop what you're doing and don't do it again. And so cease is the stopping. Desistance is the don't do it again. And we don't really have another word for that concept. So sometime down the road in criminology, we started using that word desistance for people who had a pattern of engagement in criminal behavior. So they were what the criminologists would call offenders or criminals. They were people who had that as part of their lifestyle. Then they ceased it, and then they didn't pick up again. So they went through a period of non-offending, which is a weird thing to study in lots of ways, but it's kind of the crucial thing to study. You know, if so much of a criminology is an applied subject, and we want to think that what we're doing can feed into what the work that social services or criminal justice is doing. Well, one of the main aims of a lot of the work in criminal justice, you mentioned rehabilitation, is to get people to stop offending and then help them not reoffend. In order to understand how to do that, we need to learn from the experiences of those who have desisted and done so successfully. The origins of the word are usually traced to Marvin Wolfgang, famous criminologist, A new book by Michael Roque has actually said there was usages of the word before Wolfgang. In fact, one of his longtime collaborators, Thorsten Sellén, had used the word in 1942 to refer to what we think of as dissistent. So it has long origins in criminology. You asked, what's the difference with rehabilitation? The origins of the word, when Sellén and Wolfgang were using it, and another guy, Gordon Trassler, in the 1970s, they were very explicit. They were using it as the opposite of rehabilitation. And that can sound weird, because we can think of, you know, the two have ultimately the same meaning. To be rehabilitated, you have to desist from crime, and to desist from crime, you have to be rehabilitated at some level. But the original usage of the word was to be rehabilitated means to be corrected or reformed by the state or by, you know, the social services, by education. To desist, it was originally called spontaneous desistance. These are people who were growing out of crime on their own. It wasn't a matter of being changed by some program or some intervention. They just changed on their own. And so that was the origins of, we need to learn from these, this sort of organic model of rehabilitation. In truth, both are myths. And I've argued this in my work. There's no such thing as someone who's changed by the state, you know, the outside of Clockwork Orange or our fictions, you know, nobody can force someone to change who doesn't want to change. Nobody can hypnotize prisoners and turn them into good people. They have to, that change comes from within. But likewise, nobody who actually desists say they desisted on their own, that they didn't get help from people, family, friends, society, employers, the state, you know, everyone is involved in that process. So desistance research is about trying to understand all those complicated mechanisms involved in that change.
So the rehabilitation is from the term, the word is about from without. So some outside entity,
yeah,
shaping you. And then the desistance is about something from within, but what you're saying is it's sort of a co-production where
really
it's something that happens from within, but there are these external forces as well.
Yeah, and that's a popular new term. Beth Weaver and others are talking about co-producing desistance. Some talk about it as assisted desistance or the like. You know, I think it's really important to challenge that notion, and people hardly even use the words like reform or correct anymore. Those have already become passe 1950s words, but rehabilitation has remained, and I can understand that. It's a word that we understand and know, you know, unlike desistance, and it has particular meaning in terms of the purposes of punishment and so forth. As a goal of prisons is rehabilitation, and I think it's a noble one and important to maintain that, arguably, and I understand some of the criticisms of it, but desistance, it's an important challenge. So when we talk about changing the language to assisted desistance, it's to remind those who think of themselves as being in the rehabilitation game that, you know what, you're not doing this to somebody, you're doing it with them. And you're assisting them on a journey that ultimately has to be their journey, because you can't, and they know that. I say they, you know, I could be seen as part of that. You know, when we're working with prisoners, I volunteer, I teach in a prison. I've done that for a long time. I don't see, when I'm doing that teaching, I don't ever imagine, and neither do any of my colleagues in the prison, imagine that they're changing people in the way a doctor can cure a patient. They know they're working with people where they are. And that's what the language of desistance tries to remind us, yeah.
Okay, excellent. But one thing that you said that I thought was interesting is you used the phrase, you said growing out, like people grow out of something. Can you talk a little bit about this connection? Because I know I've read in the literature this connection between age and desistance. Yeah. Can you talk about this sort of connection?
Sure. I mean, it's a huge correlation. So So huge. We sometimes talk about it as one of the kind of seven or eight settled facts about crime, that there is a relationship between age and crime, at least in the terms of street crime. Now, we're not talking about corporate crime or political crime, state crimes. We're talking about street crime. Is largely seen as a young man's game, and the man part is not me being sexist. It's a huge disparity between men and women, and then there's a huge overrepresentation of young people and involved. The peak age of criminality varies between 16 and 21 years old, but it's somewhere in those late teens, early 20s. It sort of plateaus in the mid-20s, and then it starts to drop dramatically around age 28, age 30. You get this huge drop in crime, to the point that some commentators have said there's no better crime-fighting tool than a 30th birthday. And in fact, that was the criminological consensus, really, until the desistance research started explicitly in the 80s and 90s. There was a sense, the Glucks, Sheldon and Eleanor Gluck, back in the 1940s, had a theory called maturational reform theory, and the theory was criticized because it wasn't well developed, it was a circular argument they were making, basically. The simple summary of the theory was that people grow out of crime, and the kind of consensus going forward to all the way to Gottfredson and Hershey and their famous general theory of crime, Wilson and Herrnstein and their 1985 book, was that spontaneous desistance happens to everybody. We don't know why it happens. It just happens. It's like puberty. It's something that we can see in every society, in every culture, and therefore must be this kind of automatic process. And again, the correlation is strong enough and appears frequently enough. You know, you can find references in Shakespeare to the age between 18 and 23 as this dangerous time when young men can't be trusted. So we've known young males in particular for many centuries have been seen as this dangerous class in various ways. But the desistance was born when we basically decided to challenge this theory, which was really just a correlation rather than a theory, but to say, we need to unpack and unpick this notion of maturation. It's too easy to say that age causes crime. I mean, age is just a number, as we know. There's huge differences in when people desist from crime. Some desist at 16, some desist at 19, some not till they're 35. What do we even mean by taking a correlation and then making it a theory and saying, turning 30 causes desistance? What is it about turning 30? And that's what our researchers try to look at. Is it are there opportunities that are different for young adults than are for adolescents or people in their early 20s? Are there expectations from society that differ? You know, do we look at the 21-year-old who's getting drunk every night differently than we look at the 41-year-old who's getting drunk every night? You know, there's different social pressures, shaming mechanisms, stigma that goes along with different age groups. We kind of expect, like Shakespeare, those 21-year-olds to be sowing their wild oats and to be coming in late and hanging out with the boys and so forth. And we expect different things at different ages. So it's all those kind of the economic, the historical, the personal, psychological, sociological dynamics that we look at when we try to understand desistance.
So it's taking something that's very generalizable across time and culture and something that's become like an accepted axiom in the discipline and saying, whoa, it's an oversimplification to just say you turn 30 and you desist.
Yeah.
and you want to unpack it and understand it.
That's right. I mean, that's what we do in social science. We try to complicate things that are common sense and try to get underneath that common sense. And it's been, you know, these 30 years, desistance has become one of the most published about topics in the field. It's arguably today what our delinquency theories were in the 50s and 60s. You know, why do kids get involved in crime has become why do older men get out of crime? And it's the same kind of energy we saw 30 years ago around delinquency we're seeing now on desistance. So yes, has been a rich area of study.
And it's very intuitive. I know, like, just at a personal level, when I was, you know, 18, I, you know, joined the army, jump out of airplanes, you know, do all this crazy, these crazy things. And, you know, policing, you know, oh, I want to chase cars. I want to do this. And now that I'm older, I'm in my 40s now. And I would just not engage in those behaviors now. I don't know if it's because it may be in part because of the expectations on me that society places. Is it, there's some biological element. I'm sure there's a, you know, with the testosterone levels, there's probably a whole host and experience, and there's a whole host of things that go in there. So it's, I can imagine it's a lifelong exercise trying to unpack something so complicated.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and as you say, it gets at these big issues. You know, why are soldiers? You know, why do we recruit among the young? And as you say, there's all sorts of fascinating aspects to the question. Yeah.
And I have police officers who listen to this, and I'm sure they can, on a regular basis, interact with people who say, you know, you run them through, you stop somebody and they've got prison tattoos and they've had this long, it's obvious that they've had this long experience. And as a police officer, over time, you learn to recognize, well, if they're above a certain age, you're probably going to have a slightly different experience. And that you learn that from having conversations where people will tell you, like, I got tired. I got tired of that, you know, I couldn't do that anymore. I'm done that. I'm doing this now. I got kids now. I got grandkids now. I got a job. You know, there was this change over the life course that, even though you may not be thinking about it in a systematic way, I think it is intuitive to the officer listeners out there. So this is this idea of desistance. It's something that's not new, but it's really become in vogue in the last couple decades. What have governments done, like, around the world? Is this something that has taken off? Is it something that's afoot with governments in the recent past?
Yeah, absolutely. So for, you know, the first 15 or 20 years of the desistance research, it was largely just an academic concept, and you would take it outside of academia, and people, as I mentioned, wouldn't know the term, wouldn't know what you're saying, and so forth. But it has moved from the academy into the real world in lots of ways. So certainly in the UK, Ireland, other parts of Europe, but also in the US and Canada, you can't go to a conference, certainly in probation, community corrections, without hearing practitioners talk about desistance thinking or the desistance paradigm, thinking differently because of desistance, desistance-oriented policing even, and desistance-oriented this, that, and the other. Sometimes this is empty language, through no fault of anyone's, they're getting confused with the concept of rehabilitation. They just think this is a new term for saying the same old thing in terms of prisons being, you know, desistance focused. I had the worst, most cynical misinterpretation I heard once. I was at a conference. It was asking somebody if her prison, she was in a prison psychologist, if her prison was doing anything in terms of the arts or getting prisoners involved in those sort of things. And she said, no, we're entirely desistance focused these days, which she didn't realize I was a desistance researcher, and no reason she should, but you know, the irony is, you know, desistance researchers are very interested in the arts and so forth, and her interpretation was, no, we only talk to prisoners about their offending, and because that's what desistance meant to her. But That's fairly rare. Most folks who are using the term actually do get it, and there has been a kind of light bulb moment for a lot of folks in criminal justice. Most will use the term desistance to refer to like strength-based programming. Strength-based idea comes from a critique of most correctional programming is seen as focusing on risk, focusing on needs, and is deficit-focused. So there's a kind of paternalism where we're going to correct you. You have criminal thinking, and here we're going to show you the right way to think, and so forth. Desistance-oriented practice has come in to say, actually, you know, prisoners, probationers are people with a lot of strengths as well as risks and needs. They have talents that we need as a society, and giving them opportunities to show these talents. So you know, they would be more like things like Inside Out or Learning Together classrooms, where prisoners are sitting side by side with university students and are treated as kind of experts by experience, rather than being treated as, well, you're all illiterate and you don't have life skills, so we're going to teach you, here's how you should act in society. It's giving them a different expectations. We talk about that with maturity as being changing expectations we have for people. So strength-based or desistance programming would go in with the assumption that these are good people who've made a mistake and need a way to prove themselves as the good people that they are. So there's a lot of emphasis on empowerment and giving back, community interventions where they're able to make some contribution to their community, prove that they're more than just the sum of their offenses. But also things like mutual aid organizations where prisoners are put in leadership roles who are acting as the deliverers of treatment to their fellow prisoners or acting as fellow travelers in a mutual aid sort of situation. You know, these are the kind of interventions that we are often seeing the label desistance focused when we hear talk about.
So it's a very rare instance where you can say, so there has been, like, I feel like we're constantly talking about how everything's negative.
Yeah.
You can say with some confidence that over the past couple of decades, you've seen this growing within these institutions throughout in North America and in Europe. And it's sort of, I'm not saying that the problem is far yeah. from being fixed, but you see some positive movement where this academic idea is filtering in to practitioners and making real change in people's lives.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah. Again, yeah, I want to balance that hope and then sure. being overly naive. Obviously things are very bad. I mean, I mentioned being in Belfast for 15 years. I was in England for 10 years before that. So I've been in the UK for a long time. So this is really the place I'm most comfortable talking about. And our prisons right now are in a crisis. They've kind of always been in a crisis, as many would say. But in terms of violence, staff, prisoner conflict, numbers of suicide and self-harm, we're in a really bad place with the prisons, and this is even before COVID. With COVID now, we've got 23-hour lockdown and so forth. So I don't want to be naive right. and say that, you know, desistance has saved the justice system sure. because it definitely hasn't. But the question is, are there pockets of important good work going on that's been motivated by some of this desistance theory, or at least supported? You know, oftentimes the practice is already happening, and then they discover the theory and say, that's what we're doing. And the theory can give them a rationale to keep going with that, and it can be an important motivator and so forth. Definitely, I've seen that. And yes, there's been some good work in that regard, yeah. Maybe the best thing that I've, you know, the thing I'm proudest of with desistance research is the number. I think there's always been a role for ex-prisoners to get involved in the correctional system, so-called, in some way or another. But I think there's been a real explosion of that with desistance research. And so we see prisons scrambling with inspectorates and others here in the UK, asking them, you know, what are you doing to support desistance? A number of prisons and probation units as well will point to, look, we are employing ex-prisoners, ex-offenders, so-called, to deliver these programs. We're employing ex-prisoners to work as probation support workers and others. And this kind of role modeling, mentorship role is kind of key to the desistance process. It's one of the kind of things we have found as being supportive of desistance, that says it's great to be mentored and great to be coached, but part of the developmental process is moving from being the student to the teacher and becoming the coach, becoming the mentor to others who have gone through the same problems. You know, younger guys who are walking in the shoes that you've walked in can be a real important part of the desistance process. And that element of the research has been picked up, and you're seeing more of that, even folks who are still in prison being assigned roles that are more empowering, that are about helping others than just getting help in that passive sort of way.
And I think this is a great time to transition to the paper. We're going to talk a little bit about a paper. Your career did not end when you wrote that fantastic book. I'm going to put a link to the book, but I'm also going to put a link to a more recent paper that you wrote, which I found really enlightening. And then, especially with what's happening today, I think it's something worth thinking about. And in the paper, which if anyone's interested, read more, it'll be in the link. You talk about wounded healers. Can you talk about, like, what's a wounded healer, and can you sort of link that concept to desistance?
Yeah. So the wounded healer is the sort of the person I was mentioning, a former, someone who is involved in crime, someone these days we talk about it as lived experience or experts by experience, people who have walked in those shoes, who want to get involved in helping others avoid those same paths, same mistakes they made. And it's a remarkably common process when you talk to people who are in the harder, the deeper end of the correctional system, and you ask them what their goals are, where they'd like to see themselves in 5-10 years, they will often say, you know, I'd like to be a drugs counselor, I'd like to help young guys, I'd like to be a gang interventions worker with the Interrupters or organizations like that. This is coming from an interesting process, a very human process of looking for role models and finding few of them among correctional personnel or the criminal justice system more broadly, but finding other wounded healers who have helped them along the way and saying, well, if they've gotten through, I'm going to make it through. And how will I make it through? Well, I'll just do what they've done. And this kind of very interesting cyclical process. One of the phrases that I've heard in doing this work is desistance or reintegration is like a minefield. And how do you get through a minefield? Well, the only way to get through is to follow the person in front of you. And if they get through, walk in their footsteps. And so this role modeling process that we see among wounded healers is a kind of each one teach one. You get through, and then you turn around and you help the person coming after you to get through themselves. And it's also, as I mentioned, it's an empowering process. You can feel good about yourselves. And these are individuals who are very stigmatized, swimming in shame often for what they've done, and constantly reminded of that fact by, you know, the very the label they're given as offenders, but also the structure of the justice system is a constant reminder to them that they had done something terribly wrong. So it's an important part of the redemption process to be able to say, okay, yes, I did these things wrong. I'm not going to lie or deny what I've done, but I've also been able to take that, turn it into this valuable experience, and help others through the process that I went through. And you see that, and you've seen it now for a long time, on a kind of literal one-on-one level, often working on small groups, guys getting involved in mutual aid organizations, Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous in these other ways. But in the paper we're going to discuss, I've argued that the wounded healer impulse has gone a step further and is now working on a kind of macro level, a larger scale healing, so to speak, rather than the kind of healing one-on-one and the recovery process, more of a national conversation that we're having.
And you use the word, you use this phrase, like the, you tie it to other similar, what you call them social movements, where, yeah. And you just mentioned like maybe like AA or some people that are on this journey, and it turns into something more than just the one-on-one. It turns into like a social movement. Can you just, for people who aren't familiar with that term, social movement, can you maybe just tell us what is a social movement, and how might desistance become a social movement?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's not one I'll answer easily, partially because I'm not a social movement expert, but also those who I've consulted have a variety of different definitions. And it's one of these words, a bit like desistance, but I think even much more so, where it's very difficult to pin it down and to give a definition of what is a social movement. Some of the definitions I've seen say, you know, it's obviously an aligned group, people who have something in common, who are using tactics unusual means to get a wider message across. That's a pretty weak definition, but these professionals' definitions are a bit fuzzy as well. So it's it's one of these things, we know them when we see them, and actually, oftentimes you only know it was a social movement in retrospect. But we've had social movements. The most famous, of course, is the civil rights movement in the United States, and that movement was so successful that it spawned multiple new social movements, they were called, in the 1960s and 70s. So a movement around LGBTQ rights, a movement around women's rights, and so forth. Although there's been women's movements preceding the 1950s as well. And the most interesting in the article are parallel movements in addiction recovery and also mental health and recovery. And these movements have been very important in terms of changing the narrative in those fields. So people who have gone through the addiction process and recovered weren't always speaking out, weren't always able to have the voice that they've got today. That was a long process of organizing and developing a social movement around recovery and making, you know, now we see recovery parades, we have recovery day, we have, obviously communities and networks that have lasted a long time, but they're also coming out with recovery and getting that message to the wider world. Something we've not seen with prison issues, but I argue in the paper that it's starting. Where we can see the initial roots taking shape of a social movement around desistance or around ex-prisoner issues.
And so it's a sort of difficult to describe, but it's this movement begins to take place. But you talk about in the paper how it's a trend. There's a transition from the scientific pursuit, and like you're saying, this term coming from deep in the bowels of academia, you know, like it's not something that is on people's lips. And then to have it make this transition from this scientific venture into a social movement, when I think of social movements and then I think of the scientific community, I don't think of them as fitting together neatly or transmitting information. I think of them as almost adversarial in some, I don't know, in my mind. I think so. Like what is the barrier to that taking place? And maybe a better question would be, how can you bring these two very different sort of ways of thinking together? Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it's a great question, and it makes a lot of sense. So, you know, I think of it as a kind of logical trajectory, and I talk about it in the paper as being the logical next step. So part of the desistance message, when it was in academia only, when it was just an academic concept, was if we want to understand desistance, we need to listen to the stories and the testimonies and the narratives of those who have been there in the process. That we did too much kind of assuming what reformed people thought like, and not enough listening to their stories. So that was the kind of the big achievement of the desistance research on the academic community. And then when it moved into professional practice, as I mentioned, it kept with that same kind of narrative. It says that if you want to rehabilitate folks, you need to bring in the expertise of wounded healers who have been there, who have been rehabilitated, and they can convey their story, and that then others can follow that story. So again, a process of listening to the expertise. To me, the logical next step is that these two groups need to continue. The scientists and the practitioners need to continue what they're doing 100%. But really, the message is that it's time to hear from leadership amongst those who are desisting. The kind of the big national conversation we need to have around rehabilitation or prisons or the like shouldn't be led by either the academics or the practitioners. According to the theory, anyway, there should be a strong element of the voice of those who've been there, that lived experience voice. And so to go back to the examples we've given, you know, you couldn't imagine in today's world a conference about African-Americans where it was all white experts talking about, African-Americans behind their backs. You know, maybe 100 years ago, that would have been possible, you know, sort of commission on the Negro family with all white experts talking about them. But today it would be an absurdity, and there, it would never pass muster. Likewise, although this is newer, in the mental health community, you know, the advocates, those who have been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders, with other personality disorders along the way, have developed a slogan called "Nothing About Us Without Us" that says, you know, you can't be having these commissions, having these meetings and expert academic subjects without involving us in the process. So they've demanded a kind of seat at the table, and to a degree it's been successful. Somewhat, you know, some would say this is only tokenistic, you know, but when someone gets a grant to do research on a mental health subject, they almost always need to give a portion of that grant to a board of lived experience experts who will be a part of a sounding board of the wider research grant. We don't have that in criminology. We do prison conferences all the time. I go to lots of them. I speak at lots of them where we don't have any ex-prisoners on the panel. We don't have any ex-prisoners in the audience. And that's been fine. And we do good work, and I'm proud of everything we've done. But at some point, you do become a bit confused, a bit ashamed of how can we be doing this behind the backs of the people that we're talking right. about? You know, shouldn't they be here? Shouldn't they be at the head table? And that's this sort of nothing about us without us notion. And increasingly, we are starting to see that, and you hear that argument. So there's a group of criminologists called convict criminologists, and they are not entirely, but largely former prisoners who are now PhDs who study prisons and other subjects, and they bring their lived experience to the table. But there's also a variety of organizations outside of academia too that are doing really good work. In the paper I mentioned the Just Leadership in New York, which is one of the best known. There's other organizations here in the UK. We've got groups called Unlock, another called User Voice, and then a new one called Prisoner Policy Network that's doing just fantastic work. These are although they do some direct delivery work, they're largely campaigning organizations that try to get that voice of the former prisoner into the public conversation about prisons, about criminal justice in general. And it's a difficult thing to argue with. Obviously, we still need science. You mentioned the two being at loggerheads with each other. You know, I would never say we should only listen to those who have been there and destroy all the data and forget about all the scientists and all their expertise, you know, absolutely not. But I don't think the science could carry on without acknowledging this group in the way that we've seen in mental health and recovery. We need to reach a kind of a peace, and we need those voices in our theories and in our conversations that we're having.
So the moving forward, would it be fair to say that something that you've mentioned several times, this idea of lived experience, is centering the lived experiences of the people who are in the process or have, I guess it's not a never ending process of this desisting, and that you, by centering those lived experiences, that the scientific community can then know what questions to ask and a genuine partnership and cross pollination where you have people who've had that experience come into academia or partner with academics and are asking questions. It seems like the way to go. I can also see the obstacles having come into academia. I've sort of been, because when you being outside of academia, I had this image of the lefty academics who really want to like listen. And I've been sort of surprised at how insulated, like I guess maybe that not the right word, but initially I would have thought this was something that would be a lot easier than it is, and I think people would be surprised at how tone deaf academics can be when it comes to recognizing that you don't need a PhD to be an expert in something, that if you live your entire life under the thumb of the criminal justice system and you develop a set of skills and a perspective that is rich and important. And I mean, it's a beautiful life, just like any life. Do you have any final thoughts on that?
No, I think it's a great point. You know, I mean, some of it is the ivory tower stereotype, and there's truth to a lot of stereotypes like that. But there's also, you know, it represents a real threat to academic knowledge. You know, if you ever want to kind of scratch this and see what it provokes with academics, mention the term autoethnography. And autoethnography is this methodology where somebody writes about their own experiences, which It sounds a lot like autobiography, and academics, even good, good is a funny word, but even those who are supportive of lived experiences as a form of expertise will howl at this notion of autoethnography. That's not a real method. That we should eliminate that from our vocabulary. I've often said, are we saying that we don't think that someone who's been a police officer has anything to say that's useful about being a police officer? I mean, surely as sentient human beings, all of us can provide insight into the world that we're trying to understand by living through it. You know, if somebody has been to prison, even if they haven't got a PhD, they can give us an insight that the rest of us can't access. So I definitely think it's a kind of territorialism around expertise, and again, it's an understandable one. I've been on both sides. Obviously, I've been at conferences where I've presented my painstaking data, which is based on lived experiences, 40, 50 life stories, and then I'll have somebody in the audience say, well, that's totally different than what happened to my uncle, and everybody will side with them with a single anecdotal evidence of one person. It doesn't override careful, rigorous research, but at the same point, if our research is dismissing those experiences that people have, we're always going to be alienated and be that ivory tower that isn't making any impact on the world. And criminology, to our credit, has always wanted to engage in the real world. We are less ivory tower than almost any other discipline, and one of the reasons we're discreditable, stigmatized as a discipline, oh, that's not real science, is because we get our hands dirty, because we engage with police officers and prisoners and others in the work we do. So we do have some form in this regard.
So it's a tension, it's a dance that's going to probably continue.
It will, and for the good, we should be promoting this dance and this tension, and bring it into the classroom, bring it into our discussions, because it's a generative tension, I think. Yeah.
So I've taken up a ton of your time. I just wanted to touch on one more thing. Do you have a moment? Sure. We could talk. So there, with what's been happening, the George Floyd murder, and crisis that the United States is facing right now with I don't want to say policing, but social control, we have a major problem. We're in the middle of a crisis. And I'm just wondering, and you don't have to answer this if you don't have an answer. I don't necessarily have an answer either, but how can this idea of social movements, do you think, be applied to changing this system that we have in place now, or can they?
Yeah. I think what we're seeing is a social movement around the Floyd murder. I think we're seeing huge societal change happening, and we're kind of an example of in order to actually make these kind of substantial changes to society, you need bodies on the street. You need a movement like the one we're seeing. So I think it's a great question. As you say, we're in the middle of it right now, so there's only so much I can say that won't be completely changed by the time this airs or somebody listens to it. But you can hear the impact of lived experience in the movement we're seeing, even the lived experience of those who've been to prison. And I think. Although there's other things going on, it's a wider civil rights movement that we're seeing. It's a poor people's movement. There's all sorts of important movements that are being mobilized by the Floyd killing. One of them that has been given impetus from this is that notion of we've got to listen to those who have been policed in ways that the rest of us haven't been. You know, you can hear it in the kind of the commentariat's confusion about what's going on. You know, how can they talk about defund the police? Don't they know the police are out there to protect us? And there's a huge aspect of the community, and you know better than I do, that don't feel that way about the police. They feel that they have a different relationship to the police. And part of the movement of the last couple of weeks has been, you know, it's time for us to listen to those voices, those experiences of people who have vastly different experiences than we do. And of course, the ex-prisoners have experienced the deep end of the criminal justice system. And so bring that full a breadth of experience to this. And those who are on Twitter, those who are you know, I'm tied into those networks, they have been very vocal throughout this and have brought to bear their kind of experiences as people who've gone through that process to say, you know, we could have told you this was going to happen. You know, we've seen this kind of brutality in our prisons where there's not maybe cell phone footage of what's happening. But you could think of them as a kind of, I don't know, the canary in the coal mine. They've been seeing this coming long before the rest of us did. And to them, it makes perfect sense what's going on. So I do think the last couple of weeks have been a good example of why we need to be engaged with and listening to that kind of movement.
And I was thinking about it. I thought about it this way, and then I also thought, what about if desistance from offending, the person who is breaching the social contract is within themselves finding a way to make the change that's necessary to find peace in the world, and it comes from within. In this particular case, the people who have breached the social contract are the enforcers, the police. What about a social movement from within the police, and who? Yes. And if that took place, then who would be your credible healer, in that particular case? Would it be the person who has offended?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or would it be the person who did it? Well, what do you think?
Well, as you say, the roles are reversed, aren't they? The offender is the enforcer in the case of so many cases of police brutality and the like. So you're absolutely right. The credible messenger, the lived experience would be maybe the officers that are kneeling and along with the protesters, officers who are able to say, apparently two of the Minnesota officers were in their first week on the job, and you just totally empathize with them. I certainly do, in the situation they're in. Other officers who say, I was thrown into the field with no training and was trained by maybe a racist as well. And I remember getting these messages as part of the training, and I saw things, and now I'm going to try to go and change and make it different. You know, I think that's the kind of the desistance narrative at work. I mean, I hadn't thought of it until you made that point, but my colleague Hans Talk, I'll have to give him a shout out on this. You know, he's for 50 years maybe has been banging the drum that police reform, much like correctional reform, can't come from outside. It can't come from on high. You know, police officers are ready and used to a new chief, a new mayor, a new public movement like this, telling them what they're doing wrong and how they should change, and we want you to do this and these kind of things, and that kind of change from outside will always bristle the rank and file, and they're going to resist in the same way that prisoners resist being reformed from on high. So real reform, real change is going to have to come from within police ranks themselves, and it'll be something that they have to buy into, something that they can feel they're doing themselves. And so, you know, working with the unions, working with the rank and file, in getting those, you need the role models, but you need those who are willing to say, you know what, there is a race problem, there is problems in the way we do the work we do with it, with citizenry, and we need to change, but we need to do it ourselves and come from that kind of organic leadership from within, I think is really essential, definitely.
And when I read your piece, this idea of the credible
messenger.
I mean,
yeah.
As a police officer, hearing, you know, one of your fellow police officers, especially if it's somebody who you've been working with and you know is down for the mission of police work, and it just means something different when it comes from them.
Definitely. Well, and you know, we see this with Jim Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis.
Absolutely.
It's so much a better messenger than me telling the military, you know, you need to stop being so, you know, brutalizing our own citizens. Mad Dog has a great deal more credibility than I have with that population. So,
right. Only Nixon could go to China. There are certain people based on, you know, your past performance positions you to speak to something and be recognized. And the prisoners, someone who's been to DOC has lived that experience. If I were a young man in DOC and I wanted to change, I would look to them because they understand.
Exactly.
So I really appreciate your time. I've taken up a ton of it already. I just wanted to give you one last minute. Is there anything that is on your mind that you'd like to share, or final thoughts for people before we send them on their way?
No, I just really appreciate the opportunity here. I appreciate you linking to the paper. If people are interested in, if they've listened this far and want to get in touch, I'm sure this goes for getting in touch with either of us. I'd be very happy to. It's rare to have such a great conversation as this. And if people want to keep it going, I'd be very happy to.
Great. I'll put your contact information down below, along with the paper, your book. And if anything else you want, just send it along. And I really, again, just want to thank you for your time. I know that you're busy. Everyone's busy. So thank you again.
Wonderful. Yeah.